The objective here is not only to improve the level of professionalism in the bar, but from my point of view, it's certainly to provide some protection for consumer clients whose funds are deposited in the bank in trust accounts over which the lawyers have only a fiduciary responsibility and not a choice about using those funds to provide for their own needs. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Schumacher.
One of the main objections that the banks articulated to me about this bill is the high cost of not administering it, but setting it up, changing the computer programs or whatever it takes so that they will be equipped to do this, and which raises the question whether the bar is prepared to pick up that tab, reimburse the banks for their cost of setup as well as their cost of administration.
This was clearly something we hadn't contemplated, was us picking up the tab for doing that. We do recognize that there will be an administrative setup. I don't know specifically what banks in other states have done. There are currently 13 states running this kind of program. The state of Washington's program will be effective next Friday, this coming Friday, the 1st of March. So the banks up there, many of which are very large banks, have found ways to accommodate the program, and in fairly short time spans for many of them. There is obviously software programming available. I'm sure that it can be managed. We also feel that whatever kinds of fees the bank is going to charge, banks will charge to lawyers for maintaining and giving us the notification will perhaps in the, you know, over the long run help absorb some of that cost.
What's the penalty now for doing that, taking money unauthorized?
Well, it violates disciplinary rules.
What's the penalty? Just maybe we ought to
I guess it depends
upping
on
the penalty.
Yeah, it would depend, I think, on the severity of what happens, of what the conduct is, and you know, it can be from a 30-day, you know, from, I suppose, just from censure to disbarment, depending on what someone does. Every case is different. It's very difficult to say what the penalty is. There is no specific penalty for overdrawing your client trust account.
I noticed in the materials in the recent handout from New Jersey, New Jersey's legislation speaks to financial institutions that agree to report. In other words, it's permissive. I don't recall in 427, it would simply be a mandate, would it not?
Well, I believe, and in New Jersey's case also, the banks are not necessarily required to participate, but lawyers are required to put their trust funds in participating institutions.
And is that how 427 is drafted?
I believe so.
Not required.
That's what we intend. Yes. We're talking about the current language that's before you. And you'll notice that this enabling language is more flexible than the original draft that you had in the bill. And part of the reason is so that we can continue to work with the banks to resolve these differences in terms of cost and administrative inconvenience. And I think we've made significant strides already in doing that.
So it's been amended since the original bill, is that it?
We haven't done anything since the original bill that I'm aware of.
It was, Bob, was it enabling?
Yeah,
the
originally? Is that before the committee? The
Dash 1 amendment?
Yeah.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yeah.
The Dash 1 amendments, as far as I'm concerned, haven't not been adopted. We haven't acted on Dash 1 amendments.
Well, that's right. But that came out, Madam Chair, it came out of our meetings with the banks.
Everyone have Dash 1 amendments, please.
Madam Chair.
Schumacher.
I'm reading that for the first time, and it, if I read it correctly, this would not be mandating that the banks participate in the program, but merely providing the rules of the game if they do. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. I thought I heard a witness testify that this would require the banks to notify the bar of trust account overdrafts.
Okay, I may have misspoken, but the idea is that a participating bank would do that, and lawyers are going to be required to put their trust funds into participating banks.
Oh, I see.
Whether or not every bank chooses to participate. is the way the program is envisioned.
Very good.
Would you all, somebody needs to tell us about the Dash One amendments.
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe our general guest.
George Reamer with the Oregon State Bar. I think answering Senator Hambly's question may be the most direct way. This does not require banks to participate.
The Dash One.
Yes. This just sets up a procedure by which the Board of Governors and the Supreme Court can enact rules and regulations to allow for the implementation of the program. And what we've provided is immunity for the banks from any claims arising out of their participation, and also allows them to charge fees against the lawyers' accounts for the administration of the program. So we've had a number of meetings with the banks and have tried to take into consideration their concerns, which I think we felt were primarily addressed in the immunity provision as well as the cost recovery provision. And we certainly fully intend to continue to work with the banks, because we will have to present the actual rules and regulations back to the board and the Supreme Court, and it will only become operational when adopted by the Supreme Court. This is authorizing legislation to enable us to do that.
Okay, then Senator Hill has a question too. Go ahead if you have a question.
Yeah, I want to pursue a little bit further my question about charging the lawyers and the law firms the cost of setting up the program. As I read the language, and maybe Mr. Davis can respond to this from his PUC experience, it says the banks may charge lawyers or law firms for the reasonable cost of the reports and records required by this program. I would think the reasonable cost would include amortization of the cost of setting it up on your computer in the first place.
Well, that is certainly a possibility, but as far as I know, and I've really tried to inventory all of the trust account overdraft notification programs throughout the United States, I'm not aware of any state, and there, I think, are 13 states that have trust account overdraft notification that require the bar or the lawyer to pay for the cost of amortization. It certainly will be a bank business expense. And in essence, it's here to protect the public. And I think we all end up
I was talking about language. And,
yes.
And if I hear you correctly, it is not the intent of the drafters of this.
This
was
not
reasonable cost include that amortized cost.
That was not the original intention. It's basically to cover the cost of the reports that are provided as overdrafts occur. And it wasn't really intended to cover the full amortization of the implementation of the program.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. How big of a problem is this? How many instances have you had? And
well, we're not really currently receiving any overdraft notifications periodically, and I think addressing Senator Cohen's question about sanction, ordinarily, if it's an intentional misappropriation of client funds, the lawyer is disbarred, absent something like a mental disease or defect defense where they don't know what they're doing, whether it be by alcohol or drug abuse. As to instances, fortunately, I think we've been pretty lucky. I'd say a few lawyers every year or so are disbarred for misusing client funds. However, we did hand out a report from New Jersey, which has had the overdraft notification program for 5 years. You can really walk through that report and see the specific instances where that program has identified lawyers, and we're talking about large dollar amounts. Tennessee just recently did a survey of 5 years, and they indicated that they could identify losses of $8.4 million occasioned by the misappropriation of trust funds by 40 lawyers. So even though we don't have a lot, lawyers, depending on their practice, have access to a substantial amount of money and can quickly devastate many, many clients.
I'm sure. I understand what you're saying. I'm just trying to give me some instances that have occurred here in Oregon.
We have a couple, and I'd have to almost pull out our documentation to substantiate. We had one lawyer on the coast who early on, I think a few years ago, had some overdraft problems. We investigated. We thought that the lawyer had just been making some clerical errors, and he was admonished, which is kind of a warning, correct your practices. Later on, it turned out that he was not correcting his practices. He was misusing his client's funds. He got to the point where I don't think he could face life anymore, and he killed himself. And we then have had to deal with many, many client security fund claims to pay, hopefully to try to pay the people back for what they lost through the dishonest conduct of the lawyer.
All right, so within the last 5 years, how many instances have you had?
As far as misappropriation of funds, 5 years, probably 8 to 10. And that, we're talking about disbarrable misconduct. Trust account overdraft notification isn't entirely just to try to do that. It's educational to make sure that people are properly administrating their funds so that not only do you get the people that may, early on, get the people that may be attempted to misappropriate funds, but also just to commingle. You're not supposed to be commingling your own money with your trust money. You're supposed to keep those separate and apart and have proper records. So if we can early on catch people to make sure that they understand what the rules are and that they hold that money inviolate and only for their clients' purposes, I think we're much ahead, and that will elevate, I think, the professionalism and the overall proper handling of trust funds in the long run.
Madam Chair, could I help, please? You say this plan is voluntary for the banks.
Right. They're not required to participate.
Well, if you enact these rules, I assume then that the rules would not, you wouldn't ask the Supreme Court to adopt the rules if banks refuse to participate.
No, the rule would require lawyers to deposit their trust accounts in banks that agreed to participate. So it's an optional thing on the bank's part, but if they don't, then they are foregoing the business of the lawyers concerning the handling of their trust funds. And that's a business decision for the banks to make. But I might mention that California has adopted this. I've just been advised that Nevada has adopted this. Idaho has adopted this. Washington has adopted this, and a number of other states. So this is hardly a brand new novel program. But we do believe, based on the experience of the 13 states that are in the process of implementing it, especially states like Minnesota and New Jersey that have had a number of years to see how well it works, that it is an effective process to make sure that we have lawyers complying with the trust account rules and avoiding heavy losses due to dishonest conduct. And it's not necessarily numbers. One lawyer with a successful practice who may be in over his or her head can quickly lose an incredible amount of money. And we have only so much money to be able to pay back through our client security fund.
I'm sure. Yes. How many of these accounts are we talking about?
Lawyer trust accounts?
Yes.
I would guesstimate we're probably talking, I know that the interest on lawyer trust account program has about 2,500 accounts, probably 5,000, 5,500. It's hard for us to know exactly how many interest-bearing trust accounts there are in addition to those that are in the IOLTA program. I would say in that neighborhood. There are about 5,500 active private practitioners in Oregon.
And generally, each one has at least one client right. trust account.
Though, obviously, with bigger firms, there are many, maybe hundreds of lawyers in one firm just having one master trust account.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Let me just pursue a little bit more on the extent to which we really have a problem here. When you have a case of a lawyer abusing a trust account, I assume then you do have access to the records of that account.
Yes, if a client complains.
And what have you found over the past 5 years in reviewing those records where there were overdrafts drawn on that account, either, preferably early in the game, but to what extent have you found overdraft abuse in those accounts you've been reviewing for client trust account abuse?
I'm not too sure that we targeted on overdrafts because, of course, we might be looking at just one specific instance of a client saying, lawyer gave me a check, the check's no good, where's my money? So I don't know that we would then do a comprehensive audit just to establish maybe a violation in that context. But in meeting with the banks, and we would have to maybe ask them for more specific information, but as I understand it, I think it was the representative of U.S. Bank, one of them, had indicated that just they're checking their IOLTA trust accounts in that bank, they could identify quite a number of trust account overdrafts that they were already aware of. That would be subject to report under this.
Would that get at what you're trying to get at?
Yes. We want an early intervention.
Well, I guess what I'm concerned about, it doesn't look to me as if you have built your case to demonstrate that we need to do this and impose this kind of cost in the bank.
If you look at the New Jersey report, it's hard to refute.
Oregon. I'm talking Oregon.
Well, I think that's a comparable situation. Lawyers are basically in a fiduciary position throughout the country. We have California, all of the western states except Oregon have either adopted this and are implementing it or that it's already operational. Idaho is operational.
That's what my question is.
Yeah.
Senator, it may not be exactly responsive to your question about how many cases there are that involve lawyer trust account violations, but I know that in my 2 years serving on the board, we spend a lot of time talking about the client security fund and the number of claims that come into that fund and the number of people who are limited because of the rules of the fund and the limited availability to their $25,000 recovery, but who look to the Oregon State Bar as a source of retribution, if you will, for these things that lawyers have done to them. And we search all the time for ways to try to cut those losses, both for the fund and for the clients. And this is one way that we felt that has demonstrated success in other states that would enable us to do that and be less invasive and less perhaps difficult to sell to the lawyers and maybe the legislature as well as some kind of a random audit program, which other states have as well. Washington is going to have both starting next week. They already have the random audit program. But anything we can do that will help us save the clients money from unscrupulous lawyers, we feel is worth the administrative, because it is a one-time expense.
I might just make one other comment that I did put together a book of all of the overdraft trust account over notification programs in the state, in the United States, and I think we've provided Bill Taylor with a copy of that. And really, we can go through and pull and extract the specific instances of losses that have occurred as a result of misuse of trust funds and demonstrate, I think very successfully, that this does work. It's kind of hard to concept to see what you prevent, but there are instances where you can show that after the fact, lawyers have misappropriated, in some states, millions of dollars of client money. And I think it doesn't take too many of those situations to demonstrate the value of this overall.
Okay, I'm interested in the random audit program.
What it is?
How much does it cost? Who does it? Who pays for it?
Well, random audit, there are a few states that have it, not many. I think New Jersey may, and I think Washington has. Washington's had it for a number of years. Who pays for it? I think the lawyers end up paying for it. What happens is they put all of the private practitioners more or less into a pool and then randomly pull out a certain number to go and examine their books and records to make sure they're in compliance. Lots of times it's educational, again, just to make sure that they're properly administered in their trust account. Other times they may uncover some misappropriation or some impropriety, and then they would investigate that and take disciplinary action, as we would if we received a complaint directly from a client. I think the one maybe downside of a random audit program is that it is truly random. You're only hoping, just by statistical sampling, to uncover impropriety. This program is maybe a better middle ground, because there actually is something that the lawyer has done, which is an overdraft on trust funds, which triggers the bar's involvement. So it is less intrusive. I think the three basic...
Probably would depend on your point of view, who you were, whether you were a bank or whether you were a lawyer.
Well, the lawyers, I think, aren't that inclined to like a spot audit, because it is truly random. They haven't done anything wrong, and all of a sudden the bar comes with their auditors and makes a thorough review. And to really target people who may be having problems with their trust account, I think, is more prudently when somebody is overdrafted, as opposed to not having done anything wrong and then having to go through all of the expense of a spot audit.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's hear from the other side on this issue.
Madam Chair, I understand Justice Carson is here and may have some comments to share with us if we might recognize him. He may be under something of a time constraint.
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, I'm here on Section 345. If there are questions for resource, if there are questions on this, I'd be glad to respond to them. I do not intend to testify over more than what's already been testified to. If there are questions, I'd be glad to respond to them.
It doesn't relate to the Trust.
Let's have the banks come up, and then we'll get Justice Carson here on the section, the other section. I guess we ought to say financial institutions.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association and the State Chartered Banks of Oregon. You've had a very good description of the bill that's before you and obviously the Dash 1 amendments. We think it's very commendable that the bar wants to police its own, but we don't want to be involved as the policeman. This program, in spite of what's been said, does not work well in other states. We've researched the 13 states. And we find that they've had extreme difficulty in its implementation, even to the point of postponing implementation. We've not talked to a single banker, large and small banks in those states that don't oppose the proposition. They also exclaim it was forced or crammed down our throats. Judicial rulemaking, not legislative action, has been used in the other states. And judicial rulemaking would be the case today in Oregon if it were not for Oregon's Right to Privacy Act. In Florida, the bar, quote, realized that the inability of many banks to comply without major changes in their bookkeeping system made the program impractical. The bar, and I'm continuing the quote, the bar was concerned that in small communities particularly, the banks might opt not to handle attorney trust accounts and would leave lawyers without essential banking services, end of quote. There's a letter to the Florida Bankers Association, which is the source of the preceding quote attached to my testimony. In the state of Washington, where the Supreme Court imposed the program by rule, it's supposed to be effective in March, and I can tell you that there are a number of banks, in spite of what you've heard, that don't know how they're going to comply. In California, implementation is proving extremely difficult. In Idaho, they have 300 trust accounts from border to border, and as a matter of fact, gave the Idaho bankers a plaque for complying. The fact is, most banks will have to handle this manually. I know one bank that has 466 IOLTA accounts, 466 interest on lawyer trust accounts. Not all, they don't know how many lawyer trust accounts they have. It's taking 42 hours of manual labor today. They cannot afford to reprogram. NSF check notices are processed mechanically today. To make copies of a selected few or to sort them out is just an impractical difficulty.
Okay, Frank, why couldn't you just have a regular NSF notice go
to the bar?
The first response, Madam Chair, is we don't know who the lawyer trust accounts are today. We don't know. There are lawyer trust accounts that we couldn't identify. They're not identified by number or by name. We have no idea. The bar suggests that they can have an individual bar member give us the number. Okay, now we know the number. If we are preparing NSF, if we're a large bank and preparing tens of thousands, and that does happen, of NSF notices, we would have to program to sort out those that have this particular number. In the case of the second largest bank in the state, the estimated cost of reprogramming is $55,000. By the way, it doesn't get much cheaper for small banks.
See if he agrees with that.
The bill provides for reimbursement, and you've talked about that, so I'll not belabor that. Is there no other way? We suggested that attorneys, who are officers of the court, be required to forward copies of their monthly bank statements to the bar. The bar could review the statements submitted by its own members, not by the banks, and search for NSF checks. Then they could take any kind of disciplinary action on their own that they care to take. The bar responded that it was not it was not prepared or equipped to sort through all the paper. It'd be too expensive. Well, that's our problem, too, and we're just an innocent depository. Persons who receive insufficient funds checks from lawyer trust accounts are also policemen. They're the best kind. And maybe we should have an endorsement on client trust accounts that says if this check is NSF, contact the bar. The bill says that banks are held harmless for giving for any loss or injury arising out of the giving of the notice. And we respond, what about the failure to give the notice? What happens if we make a mistake, if we ignore? We also asked the question, and the bankers on my board, and by the way, this was a unanimous decision, and I don't ever have unanimous decisions on any matter, but unanimously we are opposed to this section. My bankers asked, what's next? Should we also report on school teachers to the superintendents, on policemen to their captain, on elected officials to their constituents? Should we also report on other trust accounts for realtors, property managers, and agents? The bar says that its membership supports this unconventional procedure in invading privacy, yet I've personally talked to attorney after attorney the last 4 months. I've not yet met an attorney that supports it or that voted for it. The bar says it wants Sections 8 and 9 to cover all lawyer trust accounts. I pointed out to you, we don't know what that means. It could be $5,000, it could be $10,000, it could be $20,000. The check clearing process involves handling millions of items each day. It's highly automated. It is no small matter to inject a new report into this automated system. Now, we support the bar in its efforts to deal with unethical lawyers. However, we very sincerely believe that 427 is inappropriate and burdensome in the light of what may well be of minimal benefit to the bar. We want to be good corporate citizens. However, the propriety of asking one professional to act as a watchdog for another is highly questionable. Senate Bill 427 is deeply disturbing for a more important reason. Financial institutions, just like lawyers, have an obligation of confidentiality to their clients and customers. No matter how well-meaning the intent of this proposal is, no matter what the law says, no matter what the regulations say, its effect is to breach the confidentiality of the institution of its customer. It would be much the same if the lawyers were required to report to the bank regulators information learned from a bank client of the bank's violation of a law, rule, or regulation. While the intent would be laudable, the required breach of confidentiality is an offensive principle. Beyond the point of the principle, there's numerous administrative problems. Banks do not have uniform procedures. One bank does it one way, one another. For example, some financial institutions do not immediately post all debits. An instrument may show up as an unposted item, but not as an NSF item. And by the way, the information that was obtained from U.S. National was to go back and redo their bookkeeping where they posted immediately. They don't post debits immediately. They do it on a midnight deadline. If subsequently covered, either by transfer or other credit to the account, the item would never show up as an NSF check. But Senate Bill 427 requires reporting irrespective of whether the instrument is honored. It would pose a very significant burden on financial institutions which do not immediately post all debits to review all unposted items daily to determine if among them was a check on a lawyer trust account. The proposed reporting requirement will obviously impose burdens upon financial institutions. The check must be identified as one being drawn on a lawyer trust account, and we've talked about that. In the final analysis, one seriously wonders whether advantages to the bar are worth the burdens that would be imposed and the uncertainties that are inherent in any reporting system. We would like to think that lawyers are honest. We know that some are not. I guess we could say that some bankers are not. Even those who are not, however, are not likely to overdraw their accounts. One would expect the most problems with lawyer trust accounts involve a misapplication and misuse of the funds without an overdraft being created. A requirement that NSF checks must be reported by banks will do nothing to prevent the misapplication and misuse of funds by the lawyer who intends to breach his trust and wrongfully use his client's money. We suspect that at best, the bar will discover cases of inadvertence and perhaps negligence unassociated with fraud and breach of trust. Senate Bill 427 seeks to impose a burden on a sister profession without the accommodation for the burden and expense that it may cause. The bar is asking bankers to be watchdogs over the bar's members and in so doing to establish a principle of breach of confidentiality, which is antithetical to both professions. Given the practical problems of implementation, the doubtful benefit, we respectfully request that you delete sections 8 and 9 of 427. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Question. Senator Schumer.
Yeah, a couple of questions, Frank. On the breach of confidentiality, it seems to me that a trust account is sort of different from a private account, and the lawyer is acting as a trustee for his client's money to be used in ways that the client has consented to. In effect, this bill is bringing the bar in as a sort of not co-trustee, but is certainly a participant in some to some extent in the fidelity of that account. Now, looked at that way, do you still have a problem with the confidentiality question?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, yes, I do. First of all, there's no due process in notifying the owner, law firm, or attorney that we're giving this notice, nor is the client notified in the process. The similarity would be a trust account that's opened by a grandmother in the name of a grandson for college education. Should there be a release of that information without the grandmother's, the owner's approval? I don't think so.
No.
I understand that when you're trying to do a workout, when you're trying to redo a loan to reduce interest rates or to reduce payments, and you don't have the magic language in there for some reason, then you're unable to do that and you proceed with foreclosure. Under the current law, we don't have the option of dealing with those kinds of circumstances. Now that you've made it prospective, then all lenders in the state that deal with second mortgages will know that as of an effective date, all first mortgages may be renegotiated on the basis of these items which are listed in the statute. And you don't necessarily have to have that magic language, which Senator Bunn, in many instances, people couldn't find in the instrument anyway.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think I understand the issue, and clearly, you know, a sophisticated lender is going to be able to deal with it, but the private individual may find a very different situation, and I think we're opening a real problem area there that I'm not willing to do.
Okay. Senator Hamby, any question?
No comment.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Madam Chair, I don't know if it's worth it to, I don't know if those concerns were expressed to the proponents of the bill. Maybe it's worth it to see if they can address them, because I don't see where we...
Well, I think there is a basic... It's sort of laid out, and I think that it's pretty clear. You either have an opportunity to work it out if you don't have language in, or you have some assumptions there that are notwithstanding, even if it doesn't happen to be in the contract. I think both, you know, it's a judgment call on our behalf, and I don't know how much you can work it out. It's a decision probably for us to make, and Senator Bunn.
Madam Chair, I would argue that with the amendments, the bill is clearly dealing with future situations. The lending institutions have the ability to put the magic language, as they call it, there, to protect themselves. The fact that they don't do that, they become the victim. But that is, they've got the ability to protect themselves now by putting the language there, rather than creating a situation where someone who in good faith reads the fine print can't find anything and still becomes victimized because of the change we make. I would say let the lending institutions put the language there. They can have the protection if they need it. And we haven't taken away a potential protection from someone who still may need it down the road.
Okay. Senator Bunn has made his case. Is there anyone else who... Senator Schumer.
I just want to be sure we understand what we're talking about when we speak of adjusted, renewed, or renegotiated. It wouldn't involve any new money, any new lending. As I understand it, it would only involve changing the terms of payment, essentially. It could adjust the interest rate, I understand that. But in terms of the principal, it doesn't, it may reduce that, but I don't think it could increase it, could it?
Madam Chair, I believe Section B says increase in the underlying obligation. So actions that do not affect, let me read the whole thing, actions that do not affect the priority granted to the lien of a mortgage at the time it is first received for recordation shall include, but shall not be limited to, B, an increase in the underlying obligation secured by the mortgage during any part of the term of the mortgage as a result of deferment, etc., of all or a portion of the interest payments and the addition of such payments to the outstanding balance of the obligation.
So that, it increases it in a certain way. It can. Right.
If
you defer the interest and add it to the principal balance, and then you start adding interest onto interest, you're compounding it, I guess. But you're not, it doesn't involve an additional loan. It's still a workout situation, I think. So does that ease your concern, Senator Bunn?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, no. If I may, if I gave a second mortgage, and I did that by looking at the first mortgage, I determined what the conditions of the first mortgage were, and in light of that and the circumstances of the person borrowing the money, I knew that the second mortgage could be repaid on a certain schedule. And then that person, without my approval, went back to the first mortgage, renegotiated something that was twice as long or, you know, different conditions that I found unacceptable and would not have made the second mortgage under those conditions. I'm now subject to that without my approval.
That's it.
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, I think part of the testimony we had the last time, and Frank Bronner just alluded to, in that same factual situation, if it were a workout, and if the bank... primary lender feels that it cannot work it out, what it will do is foreclose, cutting off your interest unless for some reason, and it's not the usual circumstances, there are, in the foreclosure sale, there are sufficient proceeds to cover the first mortgage, then you would get paid. But in most cases, your interest would be wiped out in the foreclosure sale.
I understand that possibility.
I think you need to refer actually to the testimony, if anybody's interested on the testimony that was presented by the debtor creditors section, and the third paragraph really talks about the people who haven't actually looked for that language in giving their seconds are the ones who are having part of the difficulty right now, but. That's their case. So it's up to, you know, I don't know how strongly the committee feels. We can set it aside, leave the debtor creditor of the bar. You know, I think Senator Bunn's been real clear on where he is on this issue. If the other committee members don't feel strong enough to move the bill, then we can probably ask the bar to come around and be more explicit in terms of what they'd like from us. It's up to it's other people's.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure whether Senator Bunn is right or not, but he has scared me sufficiently to want to find out more.
Okay. Anybody else? Any comments?
I think I'm ready to move the bill, but head count.
Madam Chair, I think we should move the amendments. So I would move the dash one amendments.
Okay, good. Senator Hill has moved the dash one amendments, which certainly give explicit effective date and put people on notice that we're not doing this retroactively. Are there objections to those amendments dated 1/28/91? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you. Let's then wait. We'll put this on. We'll postpone it really for. I think that I'm comfortable with personally moving the bill, but we'll leave it aside. Senator Brockman can go think about it, and you all can come back, and we'll dispose of it one way or another soon. We'll try to do it on Wednesdays so that we don't forget where we've been with these bills. Thank you. Senate Bill 104, We have Judge Jeldrick, who's here, David Knowles. He's back. He's here. Judge Jeldrick, Senate Bill 104.
Madam Chair and committee members, this is a bill that would make the Oregon Evidence Code applicable to hearings before the Judicial Fitness Commission. I'm here today as the Vice Chair of the Executive Committee of the Judicial Conference. The Chief Justice, who's the Chair of the Executive Committee, asked if I would come and present our position here this afternoon. The Judicial Fitness Commission was created back in the late 60s. I became a circuit judge in 1972, just a few years after the commission was created, so I've had the chance to pretty much follow the history of the commission. Back in 1984, I wrote a paper entitled The History of Judicial Discipline in the State of Oregon, which I presented to all of the judges in the state. I left a copy of that with Bill Taylor, if any of you are interested sometime in just having a little more historical perspective in judicial discipline. The first Judicial Fitness Commission hearing I actually attended was in 1989, just as I'd been subpoenaed as a witness and also stayed to watch part of it as a spectator. And I was surprised at that hearing to find that the Oregon Evidence Code was not followed in those procedures. I was later advised by a copy of the letter from the commission chairman that the commission had historically attempted to abide by the Oregon Evidence Code, even though that was not specifically required by its rules. I later was advised that the Judicial Fitness Commission attempted to follow the Oregon the rules of evidence set forth in the Administrative Procedures Act, and it became very obvious that there were no written rules that applied. I don't tend to ascribe fault to anyone, but it just became apparent that since there have been relatively few of these hearings over the years, it's been an evolving process, that no one had really addressed the issue. It appeared to us that the legislature, which had created the Fitness Commission and set up this process, would then be the appropriate body to establish what rules of evidence should apply. And then the next question is, why apply the Oregon Evidence Code? I think everyone I've talked to is in agreement that there should be formal rules, that people should know in advance what the rules of evidence are that would apply. So the question comes up, why the Oregon Evidence Code? And I would submit to you, one, because it's fair. The rules of evidence in the Evidence Code, as approved by the legislature, are based on historical concepts that have generally found to be fair over the years. They are understood by those who are most intimately involved in the Fitness Commission proceedings. The judges themselves, of course, who are subject to the Fitness Commission, deal with the Evidence Code on a daily basis, find it acceptable, certainly, live with it day in and day out, and generally, I think, find it a fair way to resolve disputes. I know that in opposition to this, it might well be said that, well, the commission is partly lay people, but it's also partly lawyers, partly judges, and historically the executive director of the commission has been a legally trained person. And I would point out that there are relatively few hearings, fortunately, before the Judicial Fitness Commission. Generally, there's time to prepare in advance, and it's our position that by applying the evidence code, people would know exactly what the rules were in advance, rather than to apply some other more vague standard. People would know exactly what the rules are, could prepare for the hearings. The hearings could be expedited and resolved in an orderly fashion. So those are all the comments I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions as to why we feel the written evidence code should apply to these types of hearings.
I have a question, but in the meantime, let me stop this public hearing momentarily, and we just, Senator Springer has to leave, and we need a quorum, I think, too. I want to take action on some bills that have been requested that we, as a courtesy sponsor, and actually another one is dealing with the forfeiture bill. This one, LC 3044 relating to crime at the request of Partnership for Responsible Drug Policy, and I think what that does is it prohibits tobacco from 1,000 feet of the school. There's another one from the same individual, and that one is relating to narrowing the therapeutic use of marijuana, which I don't know where that bill will go. And then finally, we have relating to forfeiture, one of the final bills that we agreed to sponsor as part of the committee that we just got back. These have deadlines to be filed today, and so with the disclaimer that none of us are necessarily supporting these bills, but this is a facilitation only, I would ask that the committee agree to let them be forwarded on for possible referral by the Senate President. And objections to us doing that. Thank you very much. Now, back to Joseph Williams. I have a question. I guess how much more of a case is going to be needed if a citizen has a concern about a judge and you want to bring it before the commission?
I don't think really any more of a case is such. The Supreme Court's already said that the evidence to discipline a judge must be on a clear and convincing standard, which is a step up from by a preponderance of the evidence and something shorter than beyond a reasonable doubt as you have in criminal cases. So I don't really think that the evidence is going to have to be any greater or the types of incidents would be any different. It's just that everybody would know better in advance the types of proof that would be admissible. Instead of perhaps hearsay evidence, you might well be required to have a witness there to testify firsthand.
My view
would be the exact same evidence could be brought out if, in fact, the evidence is
there. There are a number of cases right now that are, I hear from constituents periodically about these types of concerns, and I want to make sure that we're not making this so legally stringent that someone who has a concern doesn't get it raised. And Senator Hill has a question.
I guess the situations that we're talking about are, we're talking about what evidence can be admitted and versus the weight that you would give certain kinds of evidence, it would seem. And these are obviously very sensitive kinds of hearings where I guess probably the case that you'd be looking at is whether someone is some type of substance abuse of some kind, alcoholism and those kinds of things. And I guess I'm trying to understand what the purpose of this is. These types of proceedings are not necessarily to find somebody guilty, but maybe to have somebody get some kind of help or something like that. And I guess I would be just more concerned about the reliability of the evidence. I think the reliability of the evidence can be judged, but it seems to me that if there's something that's reliable, to me, whether it's hearsay or not, what's wrong with it coming in? When you're talking about the fitness of a judge, I mean, if I can establish, if I'm afraid to come in and testify against a judge, but it can be established through some evidence that probably could not come in through a usual trial situation, if that evidence is reliable, why shouldn't it be considered?
The evidence code, the Oregon Evidence Code, has been established just for the reason of allowing reliable evidence. If I were going to lose my frock as a judge, I would not want to do it through third-hand hearsay. I'd want the Fitness Commission to hear first-hand evidence, reliable evidence, that the code complies with. I would also, one advantage it has, these are very serious proceedings. The last couple, as far as I know, haven't been to tell a judge he ought to go get in a program. They have ended up with the judges resigning from office prior to being removed by the Supreme Court. So they're very, very serious matters. And the one I attended, the person presenting the evidence against the judge was Dan O'Leary, a very, very skillful trial lawyer, skilled in the rules of evidence, and I'm satisfied Mr. O'Leary would have no problem whatever preparing a case based on the historic rules of evidence.
Well, that's good if it's Mr. O'Leary, but suppose you're not that good, and you still may have something, but you may not know how to present it. And I guess, too, I'd like to know, and this is, excuse my ignorance, what is the composition of the Judicial Fitness Commission?
David Knowles, who's going to testify, I think, in opposition, can tell you better, but the composition, Mr. Knowles, 11 members? Where's David? And one executive director. So you end up with nine official members.
Okay,
one,
you got six lawyers, three of them are judges, and I could be wrong, but I don't think you're going to snow them with, I don't think you're going to snow those people, and I think that they can understand the difference between evidence that is, I think they can judge the credibility of evidence, and I'm just, the thing that bothers me is why shouldn't they be able to consider it? That's what bothers me. If it's something that can be reliable, why can't they do, they can, we're talking about, you're concerned about the admissibility, and I'm concerned about the weight of the evidence. And I think that these people can understand what, in a normal situation, what would be admissible, what would not be admissible, but I also think they would know how much weight to give something as far as whether it would be credible or not. So that's my concern. I think that the idea of this is to protect. We just had, it's real funny, this kind of cross things where the bar is, you know, they want everything. And here we're trying to keep things away. Well, I think I've said enough, Madam Chair.
Let me back up, if I may, Senator Hill, on one thing you said, that how's the person to present their complaint? Well, the Fitness Commission is set up that it investigates complaints. This would in no way restrict their ability to investigate complaints. It only results in a formal hearing if they feel that, in fact, there is evidence to substantiate what the claimant has said. So I don't see it as restricting a person who's been wronged having the right to present their case, because they present their case initially to the Fitness Commission. The Fitness Commission then hires people, hires investigators if they wish to, hires a lawyer, and in my experience, they've been skilled lawyers to present their positions. The one thing that brings this, that brought this to my attention, was an item that probably made no real difference in the outcome of the case, but would have been clearly inadmissible under the evidence code, and the judge in question was required to disclose what up until that time had been a purely private matter. It wouldn't have been admissible in a lawsuit, which the chairman of the Fitness Commission required that he produce. And it was no big deal in and of itself, other than it really brought home to me the fact the rules in this proceeding are what the majority of nine people feel the rules should be at any given time. And I don't think that's the way to conduct a good hearing, applying just basic rules of due process, where it's as important as removing a public official from office or making a recommendation to do so. And since judges deal with the evidence code, I've applied the evidence code in literally thousands and thousands of proceedings. Judges generally don't find it overly restrictive, particularly where we're talking about a hearing that people have several months to prepare for. I don't see why it would in any way restrict evidence coming in. It just assures that it's done in an orderly and historically acceptable manner.
Madam Chair, can I ask one question? In the Administrative Procedures Act, how is evidence handled there?
Well, I can't speak firsthand, but I brought a copy, and it specifically does not apply to judicial fitness hearings. It's specifically excluded, but if it did apply, the one catch-all here is all other evidence of a type commonly relied upon by reasonably prudent persons in conduct of their serious affairs shall be admissible.
So is there no relevancy
Well, let's see. It says irrelevant, immaterial, or unduly repetitious evidence shall be excluded. But erroneous rulings on evidence shall not preclude agency action on the record unless shown to have substantially prejudiced the rights of the party.
Well, it seems as though the evidence that you spoke of, whatever this thing that you're talking about, if it's not relevant, then it could then not be admitted. I mean, it seems that you want to change this from some type of an administrative procedure to a more formal procedure. And I guess I don't know whether that serves the purpose of what, especially if you have something like, you know, the rules there for the Administrative Procedures Act that seems to would eliminate something that was really irrelevant. And you are, as I say, dealing with people that are, and all of these proceedings are public.
That's correct. The hearings are public. Now, we're not talking about where a judge is thought to be disabled. I think those are still, the judge has the option whether those are public or private, but where the question is the conduct of a judge fully public.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Knowles.
Be sure and ask Mr. Knowles what the rules are right now.
Good. Let me call you back, too, Judge.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Knowles, and I serve as the part-time executive director of the Judicial Fitness Commission. With me is Richard Page, who is a member of the commission and former chair, and in fact was the chair who made the erroneous ruling that Judge Eldricks referred to a few minutes ago. And Mr. Page, as he can tell you in a few minutes, is not an attorney. I'd like to respond on behalf of the commission to the testimony by just telling you a little bit about our procedures. First of all, the commission is a commission of 9 persons. It's 3 members of the bar appointed by the Board of Bar Governors, 3 judges appointed by the Supreme Court, and 3 public members appointed by the governor. In practice, the chair of the commission rotates between public members and lawyer members on an annual basis. So that at a public proceeding against a judge, for example, in the case of Judge Garibrandt that Judge Eldricks referred to, we had a public member serving as chair of the proceeding at that point. What we do in these public proceedings is we collect evidence. We are fact finders. We are advisors to the Supreme Court. At the conclusion of those hearings, we adopt findings of fact. Each of those findings, at least in my experience, has been based on very substantial evidence. The evidence has to be established by clear and convincing evidence. And each of those findings are utilized to support a recommendation of the commission about the appropriate sanction. We then file that recommendation with the Supreme Court. Under the statute, the court has de novo review. That means that the court could accept our findings and recommendation. It normally hears argument from both parties if the judge essentially appeals that finding, or it can reopen the record. And if we have made if we've admitted evidence improperly, the Supreme Court can decide to exclude it and to adjust, reject, or correct the findings accordingly. If we have failed to admit evidence that should have been admitted, the Supreme Court is empowered to admit that evidence and to correct the record accordingly. Only the Supreme Court sanctions the judge. The commission is only empowered to issue a recommendation. It's not empowered to issue any sort of sanction. The commission discussed this bill at its last meeting and concluded that it didn't support it for a couple of reasons. First of all, because of that de novo review ability, we really are just an advisory body. Finding fact and making a recommendation to the court. Secondly, the rules are highly technical, and I don't need to remind the lawyers on this panel that they are very difficult rules. Hearsay, for example, is defined, and then there's 24 exceptions from it, and I think they are very difficult, even for lawyers who are experienced trial lawyers, to administer on in any sort of reasonable fashion. I think they'd be extraordinarily difficult to utilize when you had a public member in the chair and had to essentially recess every time you had a difficult evidentiary ruling. I think those are all the comments that I need to make at this point. I'm conscious that you're running short of time here and have other business you need to attend to. Mr. Page is here. He may have something he needs to add, or you may want to question him about our procedures.
Mr. Page, anyone have questions for Mr. Page? I guess I have a question to either one of you. So that is the issue, the basis at which you when you get to the court that finally makes it the ultimate determination, they can choose or not to choose to use the evidence that you gathered up and presented to them, right?
That's correct. Under this statute, they have de novo review, which gives them the ability to hear the case all over again if they want to. Under the Constitution, only they can impose any sort of sanction, censure, removal, suspension. Those sanctions can be imposed by the court. Okay. So that's why we serve in that.
Okay. And how public is are your proceedings at the point that Mr. Page requested information that may or may not have been appropriate, quotes unquote, to be used in the relevant?
That is at a public hearing process. In that case, we had filed a complaint against Judge Garibrandt, and we were holding a hearing on that complaint, and we had both parties were represented by very able trial attorneys. There were evidence objections made by both sides, and they were ruled upon. But they were ruled upon, I think, on kind of the reasonable person standard that is present in the administrative procedures. Now, I will say Judge Sheldrick is correct on one point. We do not at this time have in our rules a written statement of what our rules of evidence are. And we're in the process of correcting that with our own rules and the rule we intend to adopt, unless the legislature directs us otherwise, is the Administrative Procedure Act standard that you just referred to, Senator Hill, and that Judge Deldrick's read for you, which provides that all evidence of a type commonly relied upon by reasonably prudent persons in the conduct of their serious affairs shall be admissible, and irrelevant, immaterial, or unduly repetitious evidence shall be excluded.
Madam Chairman, for the record, my name is Richard Page. I am a public member of the commission. And as Judge Sheldrick did comment, I did chair the